One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
The Michael Reed Show podcast. Tune in weekdays from 9 on LMFM. To contact us, email now, michael@lmfm.ie.
Monday morning, the 15th of April. Good morning. With much debate and discussion from now till 11 a.m, this is Michael Reed on LMFM. Now, as you know, Fianna Fáil came together in the Convention Centre over the weekend for the party's 82nd Ordesh. All focus was, of course, on the local and European elections as the party faithful listened to their leader, Micheál Martin, spell out what Fianna Fáil stands for.
Fianna Fáil is the party willing to do the serious work of planning, funding, delivering, sustaining progress in our country. We are the party which shows how a positive agenda can help us overcome even the biggest problems. We are the party which shows just how much more our country can achieve. We believe in supporting enterprise as a foundation for a strong economy. We believe in supporting trade and trade agreements which allow Irish companies and jobs to thrive. We believe in using economic success to support good pensions and social supports. We believe in sustained action to build more homes and to make homes more affordable to buy and rent. We believe in helping to reduce costs faced by families. We believe in reaching out to build reconciliation and unity on our island. We believe in protecting a European Union, which is vital for our future. And most of all, we are committed to the hard and sustained work of delivering real progress for the Irish people. This is our work. This is our commitment.
And there is a new job for local Meath East TD, Thomas Byrne, which delegates celebrated.
Agus is doing to conscale, will Thomas Byrne mar Aran the Geltokta and Ish. Even.
And indeed, Thomas Byrne, Minister for the Gaeltacht, joins us now. And a very good morning to you, Minister, and thank you indeed for joining us. Of course, you hold on to your other portfolio and remain Minister for Sport and Physical Education. Were you surprised to become the Minister for the Gaeltacht? We heard the Taoiseach say over the weekend, you're on the pig's back.
I suppose I was surprised, but I suppose the fact that I speak Irish, I mean, oftentimes when there's a reshuffle, my name would be mixed up with on Gaeltacht. So look, it's a huge honour to be Minister for the Gaeltacht and the Irish language. I really mean that. It's extra work, but it's work that I will love and I'll enjoy. And in fact, very, very conscious that there are two separate Gaeltacht in County Meath, one of them in Meath East, Ballygib, and Rockharn in Meath West. And certainly I'm very conscious of the needs of Gaeltacht areas generally and very supportive of them. So I was delighted to take the job and we'll do my best in it.
Okay, but it did come as a surprise to you. You didn't have forewarning of this.
No, the Cabinet decided, I think, at about 12 o'clock and I got a phone call at 11 minutes past 12. In fact, I missed a couple of calls from the Taoiseach because I had St. Mary's School from Ashburn in the Dáil. I was answering questions and I had a few minutes. I was telling them I was expecting a call. I missed a couple of calls. So about 10 past 12, the Taoiseach was ringing to inform me.
Okay, very good. Well, congratulations on that appointment. Have you much planned or have you had even the time to think about how you're going to take on this role?
Well, look, I mean, that's certainly a challenge. I will go to Galway tomorrow evening. My Dáil schedule is light enough tomorrow as it happens. So I said I'd take the chance to go and have a few meetings Wednesday morning, come back for Dáil votes, and we'll start to engage with some of the local groups as well in the Gaeltacht areas too. Some of them have been in touch already. Look, I very much look forward to that. there's only so much I'm going to be able to get done in the next few months in that particular portfolio, but I'm going to work really hard at it and make sure it has the prominence that it deserves. It is our first language, and to be honest, when I was in Brussels, it was actually easier to use Irish than it sometimes is in the Irish public service, ironically, because Irish has official status now in Brussels, and I did use it frequently as Minister for Europe in various speeches and contributions I made at meetings, because there's full translation. And that's the same in the Dáil, really. But in other aspects of the Irish public service, it's not the same. And that's something that will change over the course of the next few years. But I certainly will be doing my bit in the next few months to drive that change too.
Very good. And indeed, there'll be a lot of work to do over the coming months, as undoubtedly delegates discussed over the weekend with the elections that are to be held in June, both the local and the European elections. Is Fianna Fáil feeling confident going into those elections, do you think, Minister?
Well, nobody ever feels confident going into an election. I mean, for the last time Sinn Féin were riding high and they did a disastrous election. You never know. And I remember making this point to people at the time that included actually a number of Sinn Féin representatives. I said, you never know what way an election campaign will turn out. The referendum recently, that looked like, you know, an open call at the start. It was far from it. So I don't think you can ever take these things for granted. You just have to keep working, putting your point across. I think the advantage that Fianna Fáil has in these elections is that we have a huge number of local councillors right across the country, but certainly in Loudermead, have been working really, really hard in their communities. And I think that will help the party vote. There's no question about that. People like to have a local councillor in their area. We have a lot of them, and we want to make sure that they, you know, they can be re-elected.
All right. And do you believe that the outcome of the local elections will have a bearing on the formation of the next government? Talking about Sinn Féin there, I don't think the Taoiseach Micheál Martin is ever too far away from talking about Sinn Féin, and indeed he was talking about Sinn Féin again over the weekend and how it would be impossible for Fianna Fáil to enter into a coalition with that party.
Yeah, I think that's correct. Look, and again, you can't take the electorate for granted, and Fianna Fáil is not going to do that. We're going to just continue the work that we're doing, making sure that we're delivering in the areas that we said we deliver as best we can, being the difference we believe in certain areas of government. But you can't take it for granted. I just mentioned Sinn Féin had a disastrous local election the last time, did a really good general election 6 months later that nobody predicted. So nobody knows what way these things are going to work out. We've set out our stall. The Taoiseach has set out our stall. I think the clip that you played there of him, where he set out the various factors that distinguish Fianna Fáil, is a very, very good summary of where we are. That we're pro-business, but pro-social supports, very much pro-Europe. And I think we've seen that European thing has, I suppose, increased public importance, and the consciousness of the public, I suppose, is more tuned to that, I believe, in recent years because of Brexit. It's very important that we take that seriously, and Fianna Fáil does. But clearly the core tasks are building even more houses, continuing to drive reform and progress in our health service, and making sure we can tackle all the challenges that the country faces that aren't of our making, such as all the global tension around the world that it does not involve us, but has effects on the country, whether it's in terms of, we saw the oil price over the last few years, in terms of increased energy costs, supply chains, all those things that affect us, but where we're not directly involved. I mean, at the weekend, God knows what way that situation could have developed between Iran and Israel over the weekend, or perhaps may develop.
It may very well.
It's very worrying. Mm-hmm. And we're not directly involved, but undoubtedly it will have real impacts here. And we got to make sure we have the right governments in place to make sure that we can deal with these things, these waves that are buffeting against our shores, that we have to try to do our best to protect our people from.
And indeed, your leader drew parallels between the situation in the Middle East and how Ireland has achieved a peace process here. Do you believe that we could be a broker for peace?
Well, look, I'm not going to go as far and say we're a broker. However, it is the case that the position that the Taoiseach has set out, and I remember I was with the Taoiseach on the Saturday that outrageous attack happened on Israel from Hamas, and we could see how things were going to pan out over the next while. And the Taoiseach and Fianna Fáil took a very consistent line from the start in relation to this. Yes, of course, Israel is entitled to defend itself, but it's not entitled to be disproportionate, and we must protect civilians. And our line, calling for a ceasefire for a long, long time, calling for humanitarian assistance, that was not shared by lots of countries. But gradually, countries are coming more and more to the Irish position, and we've seen that. And, you know, we do get some criticism from some of the opposition about our position on Palestine, but the reality is that the Irish government has been working really, really closely over the last number of months with like-minded countries in the European Union. We see with Spain, we see with Belgium, countries like that, but also with many of the major Arab states as well, who take the Irish position really, really seriously. So we are right there in the middle of discussions about the possibility of recognising a Palestinian state, but more importantly, in the immediate term, protecting civilians and trying to put an end to this.
Indeed, the Israelis take the Irish position pretty seriously and have condemned the idea of recognising Palestine as a sovereign state, saying that it would reward the terrorism of Hamas.
Well, we certainly don't want Hamas to be running that Palestinian state, that would be a matter for the Palestinians themselves. But there is a Palestinian authority there in the West Bank that's not run by Hamas. They don't have the same influence in Gaza. We think they need to be able to do their business for their people with the support of the international community. And the Taoiseach has spoken about this. We believe it is better when you do it with a number of countries together. But there are instances when you can jump ahead of the queue because you think it's right to do it or that others are really too slow. This happened before with Kosovo, where Ireland recognised the independence of Kosovo. It's still not recognised, actually, by about five EU countries, Kosovo. And there are still huge challenges in that region. So recognising a country isn't the end of the challenges. But I know that our government has done a huge amount to be, you say, a broker, but to be an influential partner for peace, for people, recognising that Israel has a right to exist, but also that Palestine has a right to exist, and the Palestinian people deserve protection and deserve, to be honest, to be free from Hamas as well, and to have a functioning country that can operate to the benefit of the people. There's lots of little, small, fairly wealthy countries in the Middle East that have done very, very well. And I think if you could get a peace process there that actually works between Israel and Palestine, I think there are endless opportunities for the people of Palestine.
Okay, do you think that the Taoiseach's ambitions as leader of Fianna Fáil on housing are more credible or realisable than that of the Taoiseach, the leader of Fine Gael?
Well, look, I think people can see the difference since Fianna Fáil came into power. You know, you can see the houses being built in various towns all around the place. So more than 100,000 houses built since we came in. We know we need a lot more. The targets that the Taoiseach spoke about, 250,000, they are informed by work that's going on behind the scenes with the Taoiseach and with the Department of Housing Minister O'Brien to bring those targets up. But you can't just announce targets. And I think that's what some parties, the opposition, make a mistake. You need to make sure you have the planning system in place. Big problem at the moment in terms of delays to that system, whether in the court. We see social housing in parts of my constituency now being delayed by court challenge, other aspects of it, making sure we have the right skills base in terms of our workforce.
Would you be concerned that Simon Harris was over-promising?
No, I'm not going to be concerned about it because I think we can do it, but I think there's a bit more work to do so that if we say that this is our target, that when you're asking me the questions, well, how are you going to reach that target, that we will have a credible answer on that. And there is work to do on that, but there's a huge amount of work underway already about that.
Okay, it's like a lot of things, whether it's housing or health or any of the other big ticket items, people will say, well, where were you for the last 4 years or the last 13 years?
But where were you for the last 4 years? There was 100,000 houses built. I mean, that's more than what was built in the previous two governments.
But still, we have all of these problems that go on.
Yes.
And some could say, where were you for the last 4 years on online safety? It was a big part of the Taoiseach's speech about cracking down on the dangers that are posed in particular to children on the internet.
Look, this is a global problem that people are grappling with across the world. And I think, to be fair, I think Norma Foley has been doing work from the Department of Education over the last number of years to try to bring some of these social media companies to the table. So I want to compliment her for that work. I mean, quite frankly, the responses from some of them have not been satisfactory. There are ways of doing this. It's very, very tricky in the online space because there's so many ways around it. It's very hard for governments to control. But I know that there will be more work done at European level because it's a major concern across Europe. But I think that you can take what Micheál Martin said very, very seriously, that this is something that I think the government can say that we're not satisfied with the responses that have been given by the social media companies in terms of their engagement with particularly the Department of Education over the last number of years, and that he has now committed that there will be action in relation to that. And I think that's really, really important. We do know that in relation to Instagram in particular, there has been a decrease in the mental health well-being of young girls over the last 10 years. And there seems to be a lot of evidence suggesting that Instagram is connected to that. I think that we have to be very, very mindful of this. This is an education issue. But I think that it's also a mental health and well-being issue as well for people. And yes, the connection has helped, you know, the world in terms of progressing and connecting with people and all that. But certainly some of the algorithms, the way they work, are deeply worrying and are being used, I think, to stir the pot in Western democracies as well, not just in relation to our children, but in relation to politics and all that type of thing as well. And that's been going on for some time. But it's something that I think we're deeply conscious of. And I think the public themselves need to be really conscious of this as well. And parents need to be empowered, because it's very hard for one parent to take action on their child. And as Minister for Sport, I would say that we have a major role in this too, because what I want to do over the next while, and I have negotiated significant funding from the Department of Public Expenditure, is to put a significantly increased amount of funding out to sports clubs to try to encourage more people to participate in sport, which is one way of dealing with this. Yes, you can take laws and deal harshly with social media companies or whatever, but let's give young people an alternative. And there's a lot of work going on in my department about that too.
An alternative way of filling their minds, fair enough. Can I just ask you finally about farmers and small businesses? The Taoiseach made reference to both in his speech, somewhat vaguely though, but can farmers and small business interpret what Micheál Martin had to say as an indication of something that they can expect, a package of support measures possibly before the next budget?
Yeah, look, there will be a package of support measures very, very soon. I can say very clearly, because the Taoiseach said it and Minister McGrath said it, and there will be changes to PRSI. I think businesses have been caught out on the increase in the minimum wage with an increase in a higher rate of PRSI. That's going to be dealt with now in the next few weeks. And I think that that is something that needs to be done very, very quickly. In relation to farmers, unfortunately, the government is not in a position to change the weather. I wish we could. It's frightening for them. I want to acknowledge the mental health impact that this is having on farmers right across the country, right across my constituency. They've told me this. It is hugely challenging. And Minister McConnell has been very, very active in terms of dealing with banks and talking to banks about payments and all that that may be due by farmers, and making sure that the department itself, through its inspections, are not putting extra burdens on farmers at this particular time, because they've enough to be worrying about at the moment, quite frankly. And I'm glad to see that. And I know that the minister is working with government to see the extent of the supports that can be put out there for farmers. I mean, look, it's just such it's our biggest indigenous industry. It's absolutely essential. We feed a lot more than our own country, but we can never take that for granted, and we need to support our farmers. And I know that Minister McConnell will be continuing to do that.
Minister, thank you very much for joining us on the programme this morning. Thank you. That is Thomas Byrne, who's the Fianna Fáil TD for Meath East, and the Minister for the Gaeltacht, Sport and Physical Education.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
Yeah, some of the comments coming to us. Tom and Navin says, Michael, Fianna Fáil said before the last election that they wouldn't go into government with Fine Gael. How is that working out for them? Trust has gone out the window. Now they've started to say we're going to have a bonanza budget, buying votes and trust out the window once again, says Tom in Navin. Another texter says, Michael, the Minister for Housing made a great laugh over the weekend about the amount of houses being built over 5 years. It's disgraceful. Our caller says, PJ in touch saying, Thomas Byrne said 100,000 houses were built over the last 4 years, but how many of those were social houses? Most of them were private builds, so the government didn't build 100,000, but about a third of that figure, PJ says. Thank you indeed for your text. And we'll stay with housing and what was available to happen cap tenants across 16 areas on the 11th, 12th and 13th of March. These are the dates that the Simon community looked at to see what was available to somebody who was looking to rent under the HAP scheme. And today they publish their the locked out of the market report, because that's the upshot of their findings. And we'll say good morning once again to Wayne Stanley, Executive Director of Simon Communities of Ireland. And a very good morning to you, Wayne, and thank you indeed for joining us. There's been a drop in the number of properties available that HAP tenants could afford. It's down to 3% of the overall total, down from 4%, as I understand it.
That's right, Michael. And that number, just to put it into context for your listeners, was back in 2021 when we were coming out of COVID and we were still seeing a decline in homelessness. There was a 28% of properties would have been available under the same snapshot that we take. I think really we're looking at across the 16 areas, there was 38 properties available within the standard or discretionary rate of HAP. You know, just three of those actually within the standard rate, and then local authorities have the capacity to discretion to increase above those basic rates by 35% outside of Dublin and 50% in Dublin.
And that's why most properties that were affordable under HAP were affordable in Dublin, because there's greater discretionary rates there. Is that right?
That's part of the reason, but there's also more supply in the Dublin area, but also more population. So a lot of this has to be taken as relative as well. I mean, really what we're looking at when it comes to the housing assistance payment, unless people have the capacity to top up, pay their rent to the local authority, which they have to pay, and also a top up to the landlord above the discretion that the local authority give them, really we're at functional zero when it comes to the private rental market, and have been for a number of these reports now. And that's why we're seeing, I suppose, on the front line of this, what we're seeing is when homelessness, or to if the landlord is selling up and they're looking to avoid homelessness and we're supporting them, is that there's very little for them in the private rental market.
Right. So is it, am I reading this right? Is it that 32 properties out of 1,180 were affordable?
So what we do is we take a snapshot of all of those properties. So that's the total in the 16 areas. That's the total of properties that we're available. But we look at what's a single person household, couples, a couple with or one parent family with one child, and a couple and one parent family with two children. So within those four household types, within that total 1,100 properties, there was only 38 of them that were available within the HAP rate. Well, so it's not that they would be appropriate or you know, they you can
affordable, sure, though.
Maybe the personal capacity of it. Interestingly, we would have, I suppose, when this report started back in 2017, we would have, or 2016 even, we would have, I suppose, held up the HAP really as a comparator with affordability in the market. But really that's, you know, with the levels of top-ups we have now, really, you know, you're looking at in Cork, say, just as to pull out one example, you with the maximum discretion for a couple with two children, it's €1,248, which, you know, should be a decent rent. But they're just, it's a lack of affordability it's a lack of affordability in the system is a critical problem now. I know we've said this on your show sort of on a regular basis, but really the long-term answer to this is more social housing.
Okay. Well, I think that's what everybody says. Delivering them seems to elude those who are charged with the task. One of the areas that you survey is Dundalk. Three properties available over those 3 dates. Is that right?
That's right. And that, I mean, Dundalk is usually one of the outliers in that there's often more availability there. So really, this constant tightening of the private rental market, we're seeing everywhere. And I suppose particularly outside of Dublin, it seems to be particularly acute. And I suppose our concern there is, that it's contributing to a level of perhaps hidden homelessness, that people are not ending up perhaps in the street, but they are having to double up and treble up in family homes or staying with family and friends. Those kind of options are becoming more and more prevalent, I suppose, within Dublin, but also outside of Dublin. Yeah.
In the box room or couch surfing with friends, as the case may be. But is it down to a lack of supply, or is it down to the HAP payment? Is it not as simple as saying that that needs to be increased so that some of the 1,100 properties that were available to rent would have been affordable for those who run HAP?
Yeah, I suppose we can't continue to chase the market rents that are out there. But I think in the short term, that is one of the levers that the government could immediately pull and give more capacity, and that would act as a break or some relief for families and individuals who are in homelessness or at risk of homelessness, and might slow the flow of families and individuals into homelessness. But in those kind of short term measures, there's also the EU has now dealt with its issues around dealing with the short term lets. And that might bring, those regulations that are in train were brought in, that might give some respite as well. That the government talk about, or the department talks about, maybe 12,500 units of accommodation coming back in if that's dealt with. Mm. Obviously, that supply would be taken up quickly, and there's no guarantee that it would be affordable if it came back into the market. So there's some caveats there. But I think if the results come in quickly, it would offer some relief. But again, I mean, we really are looking at the only way forward is the ramping up of social and affordable housing to insert affordability into the system. I mean, really, the level we need to be looking at nationally is 15,000 social houses built every year. What that would afford us to do is that would deal with the sort of the total flow into the number of households that are applying for social housing every year, and a little bit more that would allow those families who are in the HAP system currently to be sort of orderly wind down of the HAP payment, create more capacity within the private rental market that, people who aren't on those low incomes perhaps could access.
Okay, Wayne, we have to leave it there, but thank you indeed for joining us on the programme this morning. Wayne Stanley, Executive Director of the Simon Communities of Ireland.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
Why are so many people dying on the roads these days? Well, that's a question a lot of people would not just like the answer to. They'd like to see a solution put in place. And the Taoiseach, together with a number of government ministers, is meeting with the Road Safety Authority to try to find out the answer to that question. It's a question that's been answered, by the way, by the AIM2 party. Patrick O'Bean, AIM2 leader and TD for Meath West, joins us now. And 63 people have died on Irish roads this year. That's an increase of 31% on the same period for last year. And you say that the reason for this, in part at least, is to do with government policy.
These are heartbreaking statistics. There are a few of us that are not stopped in the tracks every morning now when we hear the reports of the deaths that have happened overnight on the roads. And we in AIM2 have put in parliamentary questions over the last couple of years to track what's happening in this area. And we found out that in 2009, there was 1,046 Gardaí policing the roads. Right now, that number is down to about 600. And so there's been a fall in 40% of the number of Gardaí that are policing the roads. And we know that behaviours are changing on the roads. Behaviours are changing because people pretty much know that they're not going to get stopped by a Garda typically. And as a result, unfortunately, we know from research that the stigma is reducing in the likes of drink driving and other behaviours which are very dangerous and cause deaths as well. And it's really frustrating that this is happening. It reflects what's happening in the Gardaí in general. We know that under Helen McEntee, the number of Gardaí has fallen in the force every single year for the last 4 years. And until we get to the grips with this, until we get a situation where people know that it is likely that they'll get stopped on the roads at a checkpoint, behaviours are not going to change for the better. And that's leading exactly into this crisis on the roads at the moment. And even the laws that are there are not being enforced. Like some of the stats that we're getting back are incredible. We have done studies that showed that between 2021 and 2023, 32,000 drivers were disqualified from driving because in most cases they'd reached the 12 penalty point limit. But a third of those didn't even have a license. So people are being disqualified who have no right to drive anyways. And of the people who did have a license who were disqualified, only 5,000 people actually surrendered their license after the event, as is the law. So a small minority, a quarter of those who are disqualified, and the law states that you have to surrender your license, only a quarter are actually surrendering their license. I know one person who had two active disqualifications and was disqualified for the third time from driving. So people are given the two fingers to the law in terms of the roads. And
Was that person who was disqualified, did they continue to drive?
Yeah, so they had reached, they had been disqualified,
yeah,
and they continued to drive. They had been caught for breaking the law. They've been disqualified again, and they continued to drive. And then they've been caught a third time and continued. We're not sure whether they continue to drive after the third disqualification.
Right.
But it is basically showing that the law is not being implemented.
Right. I'm still scratching my head a bit. I imagine you can understand why, because I'd have thought if you were disqualified, you were disqualified. But are you saying that when, after the first disqualification, they were found to be driving and shouldn't have been driving because they were disqualified, and then were disqualified a second time, and that repeat? Is driving a motor car when you're disqualified from driving not an offence in itself?
It is an offence. Driving disqualified is an offence, and it carries a maximum of 6 months prison and or a €5,000 fine. But those fines or prison sentences are very seldom enforced.
Even on a second occasion when the person had been caught twice driving after being disqualified.
My understanding, that is the case. And what we would like to see in AIM 2 is an increase in the maximum sentence and, you know, a minimum sentence come into place if a person is caught on multiple offences in this manner. And the other thing, Michael, it's really important to remember that the Gardaí have been promised new technology which would show them in real time what exactly is the situation of the driver. So a piece of technology where they can put in the registration plate and then they can be told, well, this person is or isn't insured.
Yeah.
This person has a full license or actually is disqualified. But that technology hasn't still appeared. So Gardaí don't have the ability to make decisions in real time on whether a person is insured or disqualified or not, which means then those people feel that they can actually chance it because they're unlikely to get caught.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, it's hard to argue with that, to say that they should be caught and they should be put off the roads because if they're disqualified, undoubtedly it's with good reason. But when it comes to this directive that came from the Garda Commissioner last week to all members of An Garda Síochána to carry out 30 minutes of road safety policing each shift. There's lots of questions about that. The Garda Commissioner is going to attend this meeting with the Road Safety Authority and the Taoiseach and other ministers today. Eamon Ryan has said he's looking forward to the Garda Commissioner explaining to him how this will work in practice. You have questions yourself about this, don't you?
Yeah, I think this is just a sticking plaster. I think if the government meant business, they would recruit more Gardaí, full stop. And to recruit more Gardaí, it's very simple. They need to increase the pay terms and conditions that the Gardaí have and also make sure that their welfare is protected. Gardaí have been attacked violently on a daily basis at the moment, and that's leading to the fall in morale within the service. But in terms of this new half-an-hour idea, I think that's literally robbing Peter to pay Paul, because we know that if you ring a lot of Garda stations at the moment, you won't get through to the Gardaí because they simply don't have the staff to be able to answer the phones. You know, in Mead, for example, on a Sunday, I know that there could be only 5 Gardaí available from Enfield all the way up to Athboy. That whole corner of the county would have 5 Gardaí on duty. If there's an arrest two of those have to go to the rest. So there isn't enough people to answer the phones. And if you're, excuse me, if you're doing a half an hour gig on the roads in your normal day, you might have to drive 45 minutes to the roadside checkpoints. You might have to do a little bit of preparation first. There'll be, you'll have to work out all of the different offences afterwards and 45 minutes back. So you could have, you know, two hours at least taken out of your day just to do a half an hour on the roadside. And that doesn't make sense either, because it's very inefficient to have Gardaí on their duty taking time out to drive to another location to fulfill another role. And so, you know, we really are just robbing Peter to pay Paul. We need to just employ more Gardaí so our roads are safer. Enforce the laws so the roads are safer.
The best time to commit a road traffic offence, it seems, is between 2 o'clock in the morning and 7 o'clock in the morning. The Gardaí Commissioner has told the Irish Independent, it's a remarkable story today, that there will be no dedicated road policing officers on duty between 2 a.m. and 7 a.m. most days.
Yeah, and this shows that the government is a ball of contradictions as well, because we're having a debate now on whether or not to allow for nightclubs open till 6 o'clock in the morning. We know in countries like Norway, for example, when you allow nightclubs open so late, what often happens is you have a situation where road traffic deaths increase because it's very hard to police overnight. And we know also that drugs are having a big effect in terms of the road traffic deaths that are happening. And the government wants to go down the route of, you know, decriminalising, you know, drugs such as cocaine, etc., into the future, which will increase use and unfortunately mean that more people will die on the roads. So, you know, the government is contradicting itself even with the policies that are bringing out. There's no logic in terms of trying to meet the objective of saving lives, because, you know, every week now we are having families completely hammered in relation to horrific tragedies of their loved ones, usually young people, dying so senselessly on the roads. Enforcement is necessary, and for the government to align all its policies in the one direction.
All right, we'll leave it there for the moment. Thank you very much, as always, for joining us on the programme this morning. Peter Tobin is a TD for Meath West and the leader and founder of the AIM2 party. Let me remind you, if you want to make comment on the show today, give us a call. 041 983 2000 is our telephone number. That's 041 983 2000. Or you can text or WhatsApp 086 1800 658. Email michael@lmfm.ie.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
Now to some more of those comments coming to us. Jerry in Dundalk, thanks for your text. He says, I think it's funny the way the government is talking about affordable housing and building new homes. Myself and my wife want to buy our own house, but the prices are insane. We've been looking at 5-bedroom, 3-storey houses in Canada, which is the same price as a 3-bed bungalow in Ireland. That's a 5-bedroom, 3-storey house in Canada for the same price as a 3-bedroom bungalow here. Jerry says, we've no choice but to leave Ireland so we can actually afford a decent home, and the wages are a lot better there than they are here, says Jerry, for that matter. Thank you indeed for that, Jerry. Hopefully it'll all come good for you. A carer who has been in touch, this is Mary, who is both a widow and a carer, says this is the latest stint from the government hitting the most vulnerable in society, who are carers. She says that on Friday last, I received a brown envelope, no money in it, but instructions to send to the Department of Social Protection all of the details on what I own and what I possess. I phoned and asked why I received this letter, given that my daughter needs 24-hour care and my time is minimal. I was told all carers in the country got these letters. Absolutely disgraceful, coming from Minister Heather Humphreys, says Mary, a widow and a carer. Thank you indeed for that. Paddy Duffy in touch about road safety, saying most road traffic offences are not and never have been detected by dedicated traffic Gardaí, but by regular duty uniform Gardaí. Thanks, Paddy. Not sure what makes you say that, but thanks, as I say. A Navin listener says, could you ask those litter louts Do they feel any shame when they see decent living people, children amongst them, picking up litter after them? Maybe they think it's other people's job to pick up after them, says our Navin listener. Yeah, I think maybe they do. I don't know. You see rubbish all the time and you think, who dropped that there and how did it get there and what's wrong with people who do that? I saw something the other day that I haven't seen for years. Something I used to see a lot, as I'm sure you did, but I was driving behind a car and whoever was in the car in front of me obviously had just finished a tin of minerals. And instead of dirtying their car by leaving the tin in it, what did they do? Well, how do I know? The only way I know is because I saw it driving behind them. They threw it out the window. Just finished off the can of stuff, threw it out the window and about the way. I just can't understand what's wrong with people. I don't know. Do they want to live in a town full of discarded cans if everybody was to do it? Anyway, I think the answer to your question, Navin listener, is no. They don't feel any shame. Anybody who does that obviously doesn't feel any shame. They don't see anything wrong with it. I take it. I assume. I don't know. I just can't understand how they do it. But there you go. Mary, thank you for your message. A lot of criticism, I suppose, in the first hour of the programme today of government, despite Thomas Byrne defending Fianna Fáil's performance in government. Mary in touch saying, Michael, I actually think that the government has done a great job. The country has less people on social welfare. People forget what a difficult time it has been with COVID, Brexit. And now the country is booming. It takes time to build houses, especially when you get objections delaying the process. People forget very quickly. Overall, Mary says, a very good job was done, apart from the referendum, which she says, it was obvious to people that the wording was completely ridiculous. Thank you, Mary, indeed, for sharing your thoughts with us. Let me just give you the numbers if you want to make comment on our programme today. It's 0419832000. That's if you want to ring, text or WhatsApp 0861800658. And just to repeat the email address, michael@lmfm.ie. Now, we are looking into the abyss, or at least you could forgive somebody for feeling that way because of what's happened over the weekend, the Iranian retaliation after that atrocious attack on an Iranian consulate in Damascus by Israel. Of course, as you'd expect, Iran has retaliated. What this means or what it will mean will happen next is unknown, but unthinkable to some degree.
The Ayatollah regime, in blatant violation of the UN Charter and international law, attacked the State of Israel and launched 170 UAVs, 120 ballistic missiles, and 30 cruise missiles carrying 60 tons of
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Explosive materials at Israel. This attack was launched from Iranian soil, as well as from Lebanon, Yemen, Syria, and Iraq. Colleagues, from the moment I began my tenure here, in every speech and in countless letters, I rang the warning bell regarding Iran. I called on this council to take concrete action against the Ayatollah regime. I made it clear that Iran and its hegemonic ambitions of global domination must be stopped before it drives the world to a point of no return, to a regional war that can escalate to a world war. Sadly, no action was taken. And last night, the world witnessed an unprecedented escalation that serves as the clearest proof for what happens when warnings aren't heeded. Israel is not the boy who cried wolf. We have been screaming from the rooftops for years, trying to wake up the international community, but to no avail. If only this council would have internalized my words, it would not have needed the bone-rattling explosions of last night's attack to wake it up. Colleagues, last night, Iran proved again that it cares nothing, nothing for Islam or Muslims. The Iranian attack seriously injured Amina El-Hassouni, a 7-year-old Bedouin girl in Israel. But look at this video that shows how Israel intercepts Iranian drones above the Temple Mount and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Here, you can look at it. This is the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Right, that's the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations Security Council, which was meeting in emergency session, showing on his iPad. He picked up his iPad to show that video of how the Israeli Defense Forces were protecting a mosque, making a point out of that. There's much concern about what's going on. Let's hear what the Americans have to say.
Iran was also, in a broad sense, complicit in the October 7 attack on Israel because it has provided significant funding and training for the military wing of Hamas. This Iranian support contributed to the current crisis in Gaza. Colleagues, these and other reckless Iranian actions are not inherently defensive actions against other member states. Given the threats Iran's aggressive actions pose for international peace and security, we have a collective responsibility as members of the Security Council to ensure that Iran complies with the Council's resolutions and ceases its violations of the Charter. In the coming days, and in consultation with other member states, the United States will explore additional measures to hold Iran accountable here at the United Nations. More immediately, the Security Council must unequivocally condemn Iran's aggressive actions and call for Iran and its partners and proxies to cease their attacks. The United States also supports Israel's exercise of its inherent right to defend itself in the face of this attack. And as President Biden stated, we will remain in close contact with Israel's leaders. And let me be clear. If Iran or its proxies take actions against the United States or further action against Israel, Iran will be held responsible. We note Secretary General Guterres' statement warning that the region is at risk of plunging into a deeper and wider war on multiple fronts. The United States is not seeking escalation. Our actions have been purely defensive in nature. The best way to prevent such escalation is an unambiguous condemnation from the Council of Iran's unprecedented large-scale attack and an unequivocal call on it and its proxies and partners to refrain from further violence.
Right, that's the U.S. Deputy Ambassador to the UN, Robert Wood. Interesting to hear him warn Iran against another attack on Israel or an attack on the United States. I think we can hear from Iran and what its ambassador to the United Nations had to say about this.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, Madam President, as we informed in our letter last night, in response to the Israeli regime's recurring military aggression, particularly its armed attack on 1st April 2024 against Iranian diplomatic premises, the defiance of Article 2 of the Charter of the United Nations, the armed forces of the Islamic Republic of Iran carried out a series of military strikes on Israeli military objectives with dozens of missiles and drones. Iran's operation was entirely in the exercise of Iran's inherent right to self-defense as outlined in Article 51 of the Charter of the United Nations and recognized by international law. This concluded action was necessary and proportionate. It was precise and only targeted military objectives and carried out carefully to minimize the potential for escalation and prevent civilian harm.
An apologetic Iran saying its attack on Israel was in line with international law.
The Middle East is on the brink. The people of the region are confronting a real danger of a devastating full-scale conflict. Now is the time to defuse and de-escalate. Now is the time for maximum restraint. This emergency session has been convened upon an urgent request by the permanent representative of Israel, who noted in his letter dated 13 April to the President of the Security Council that Iran had launched, and I quote, a direct attack from within its territory of more than 200 UAVs, cruise missiles, and ballistic missiles towards Israel in clear violation of the UN Charter and international law, end quote. Yesterday, the permanent representative of the Islamic Republic of Iran also addressed a letter to the President of the Security Council stating that, and I quote, in the late hours of 13 April 2024, the Islamic Republic of Iran carried out a series of military strikes on Israeli military objectives, end quote. He stated that the action was taken, and I quote, in the exercise of Iran's inherent right to self-defense, as outlined in Article 51 of the Charter of the United Nations, and in response to the Israeli recurring military aggressions, particularly its armed attack on 1 April 2024 against Iranian diplomatic premises, end quote. According to the latest reports, Iran launched hundreds of drones and missiles from its territory towards Israel, with most intercepted. Several missiles reportedly struck within Israeli territory, one of which damaged an Israeli military facility in the south of the country, and overall, a few civilians were injured.
Indeed, and tensions are very fraught as we speak. You heard there, the Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, says the Middle East is on the brink.
Michael Reed on LMFM.
It's a year since the legislation which allows for the termination of pregnancies in this country was reviewed by independent chair Mary O'Shea. A list of recommendations were made to government, but little has happened in the course of the last 12 months. Dirren Crossan is a women's health coordinator with the National Women's Council and joins us now. And a very good morning to you, Dirren. Thank you indeed for joining us on the programme this morning. The National Women's Council, together with another number of groups, has written to the Taoiseach to mark the 12 months on since Mary O'Shea's recommendations and have called for action. Tell us more, if you would, please.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. Thanks for having us on. Yeah, so despite the 2018 referendum, which obviously saw the public vote overwhelmingly in favour for safe and legal abortion to be made available within Ireland, as you said, many barriers to abortion still remain today, and we've seen little progress in some areas. And that has resulted in many women still being forced to travel abroad to access care. So this open letter that the National Women's Council prepared to government, which has been signed by more than 20 civil society groups, by healthcare providers, and by academics, really calls on political leadership to address these barriers. And these barriers are varied. They include the ongoing criminalization of abortion in Ireland. This criminalization is obviously, as you can imagine, a significant issue. It has a chilling effect on providers who report not being able to use, their clinical judgment without fear of prosecution. There's also the mandatory 3-day wait, which is imposed on women and pregnant people, which is also a significant barrier. in addition to other things like uneven geographical coverage across the country and legal rigid criteria for abortion after 12 weeks. And that includes in cases of fetal anomalies. So they're the reasons that we've written this letter and what we're calling for the government for.
And what you're calling for is in line with the O'Shea report, but also in line with the recommendations from the Oireachtas Committee on Health.
Absolutely. The O'Shea report is extensive. It's underpinned by, you know, brilliant qualitative research, which was conducted with women who've accessed abortion care and also interviews with their clinicians and their providers. And really what has been found is, you know, these issues need to be addressed. We need political leadership. So what we're calling for is the full decriminalisation of abortion in Ireland. The removal, obviously, of that mandatory 3-day wait, which is very paternalistic, very demeaning to women, and a review of those 12-week gestational limits. We also want to see progress with things like the safe access zones, which is moving through the Seanad at the moment, and the recruitment of a HSE primary care lead for abortion to address some of the gaps in training and data collection for early medical abortions.
And there has been some change, has there not, in that most maternity hospitals now provide abortion services?
That's correct, yes. And that's been a really positive development. And so previously, when the report was being written, there was very little coverage in terms of that support from the maternity hospitals. And that's a significant concern for GPs because they really want to act within a network where their local maternity hospital is also there to provide coverage. So there has been progress with that, that now 17 out of the 19 maternity hospitals are providing abortion care. But there's still a ways to go. The reality is that over 90% of abortions are taking place in primary care settings, so amongst GPs. So really the criminalization is affecting that coverage because a lot of GPs are not opting in to provide that care because of fear of prosecution or acting you know, outside the bounds of the Act, which we know is very rigid in a lot of regards and does need to be amended to provide, you know, better security and care for women and the clinicians that are supporting them.
So what's the upshot of all of this, Dirren? Is it that there are some women who cannot avail of services to terminate pregnancies in this country?
Yes, that's exactly it. So there are some women who are living in areas of the country that have very poor coverage, who maybe don't have the means to travel to access care. And that's a significant barrier. But then there's also significant barriers in terms of, you know, Section 11 of the Termination of Pregnancy Act around fetal anomalies. So, you know, at the moment, a condition affecting a fetus that's likely to cause death before it is born within 28 days. That's the kind of criteria that has given. But that is extremely rigid. And what the O'Shea report says is that this lacks clarity. And it's very, very difficult for clinicians to implement that in practice, even in cases where the condition might be fatal. So what we're looking for is really a review of that for the recommendations from the O'Shea report to be implemented to ensure that women don't have to travel abroad and can access safe and timely care, you know, in their own country.
And for you any understanding as to what may be causing this delay? I mean, it's 12 months on from a government commissioned report.
Absolutely. You know, they obviously sent it to the Oireachtas Health Committee, as you noted. The Oireachtas Health Committee backed the recommendations in the O'Shea report. So really, we need that political leadership, and we really need abortion to be seen as healthcare. And healthcare policy should never be frozen in time. And that is something the government needs to recognise and respond to in terms of the extensive qualitative research that's been done in this area. And obviously, in terms of guidelines that have been prepared by the World Health Organization, Ireland needs to fall in line with other countries and that to ensure that reproductive healthcare is equitable and responsive.
Are you concerned, though, that there may be a lack of political will?
Absolutely. That has been a concern, you know, for ourselves, the National Women's Council, but obviously as well for healthcare providers and other civil society groups that, you know, we don't want the government to see, you know, the 2018 referendum as that's abortion done. We did that. Obviously, just like anything, it may require amendments. They've obviously commissioned this review. This review has found, you know, significant barriers. and those need to be addressed. And they need to be addressed timely. You know, this has been going on, as you said, for quite a while. And there has been some progress, but more is needed. And that prioritization is required at a political level.
If there is a lack of political will, what do you believe might be driving that? Could it be like other issues that the rise of the right wing is impacting on the policies of government for fear of the fallout in the upcoming local and European elections?
I think that could be a concern, certainly. And I think it's relevant to note, obviously, in some countries around the world, there have been examples of abortion care being rolled back. I don't think that's a particular concern in Ireland at the moment. I think, broadly speaking, the government has been supportive in terms of the understanding that abortion care needs to be safe, legal and accessible here. But I think there's a few sticking points in terms of it being prioritised. You know, so what that's really what we're calling for, to make sure that people understand this is still an issue. Women are still having to travel abroad. In certain cases, there's still issues in terms of access when they are able to have it here in Ireland, in terms of the time. You know, some women are waiting within a week, even more, to actually see a GP to access abortion care. And that's not the fault of the GPs, of course. That is within a system that needs to be looked at and remedied in line with the recommendations of the O'Shea report. So I think the government have demonstrated, obviously, there have been certain improvements, but more needs to be done. And it's up to ourselves, obviously, and the public to maintain that pressure on the government to say abortion is not finished. There are certain recommendations and improvements that can still be made in this area.
It must be very confusing for a woman who wishes to terminate her pregnancy to be told it's not possible. It's legally impossible to do that in this country, given that we have laws in place that allow for the termination of pregnancies. And for that woman to proceed, to have to go overseas, to go on the boat, as we used to say, but to other parts of Europe apart from the UK at this stage, it must be terribly confusing, as they say, Duren, for those women.
Absolutely. I think that's an extremely harrowing experience for everyone, anyone to have to go through, to have to travel, to access what is essentially healthcare, essential healthcare. And in many cases, you know, those could be women who have just found out that they have a fatal fetal anomaly and they've been given a lack of clarity, not because of the conditions, but because of, you know, the rigid criteria within the act of, you know, what that outcome is going to be. And that's the reason why they're traveling. You know, it's a massive financial cost as well, a huge burden on women who may have, you know, other responsibilities here at home in terms of other children to care for, other care responsibilities. And really, as I said, the public voted to ensure that this would not be happening back in 2018. And unfortunately, there are still situations where it is occurring.
All right. We'll leave it there. Thank you indeed for joining us this morning. Duren Crossan, Women's Health Coordinator with the National Women's Council of Ireland.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
Let's talk about the town of Drogheda, or should it be the city of Drogheda? Well, if it was the city of Drogheda, there would be benefits under the Living Cities Initiative. Labour Party TD, who's based in Drogheda, Jed Nash, wants to know why Drogheda is being excluded from the Living Cities Initiative. How long have you actually been asking this question?
Actually, since it was first introduced back in 2014, and the needs become more acute now. I think it might be just useful to explain a little bit to listeners what the Living Cities Initiative is. A number of years ago, it was a tax incentive scheme brought in to encourage refurbishment and renovation of town centre properties or city centre properties across the country. Nobody had any difficulty with that. It was designated for cities originally. But then Kilkenny crept into it. And Kilkenny, as listeners will know, is about half the size of Drogheda. In fact, I checked the population this morning. The population of Kilkenny City is about, as it describes itself, is about 26,000. That's the population of Drogheda town around about 1996. And Drogheda town has practically doubled in size since then. Some of the thresholds...
It's always been an odd one, Michael. Kilkenny is a city, but it has a cathedral, isn't it?
I don't know. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the legal definition, it doesn't meet the legal definition of a city, but no harm to Kilkenny. We know that it's a nice place and the best.
University in a city, are they the...
Well, they seem to be the old definitions, but of course, the definition of city in Irish law is a bit sort of ambiguous, and that's part of the problem we have in terms of the way in which we want to approach the designation of Drogheda as a city. But I'll park that for a second. People will be familiar with the rates of dereliction and vacancy in Drogheda. People will know as well that this isn't a phenomenon that's unique to Drogheda. I was in a couple of towns in the south-west of the country last week on business, and I saw levels of dereliction that would be very similar to Drogheda. So dereliction and vacancy is a national problem, and it's something that needs to be resolved at national level to give local authorities the tools they need to make sure that people can refurbish and renovate properties. We're all familiar with the problem, for example, in Narrow West Street, and my colleague, Councillor P.O. Smith, last week, front page of Drogheda Independent, made it very clear the levels of dereliction and vacancy we see in Drogheda and elsewhere is actually a form of abuse on town centres. Now, the Living City initiative is an interesting initiative. If you look at Kilkenny, since it was introduced a number of years ago, 19 properties have been refurbished and renovated. So it's a tax incentive. If you own a residential property, if it's pre-1915, you can actually receive essentially 10% of the cost of that through your tax over 10 consecutive years. So 19 properties in a town that's about half the size of Drogheda benefited. Waterford benefited to the tune of 76 properties. And if you look at the sort of agglomerated area of Drogheda, it's about the same size population-wise of Waterford. Can you imagine the impact that those tax incentives will have in the centre of Drogheda? There are about 40, I think, properties in the centre of Drogheda that are in a state of dereliction now on derelict sites registers. We know that the Derelict Sites Act itself is ineffective. The laws look really, really good. But the problem is the issues that local authorities have in enforcing the Derelict Sites Act. If you think about it, 7% of a levy is to be applied to derelict sites every year, 7% of the total land market value of land and property. And that's rarely done because there are so many loopholes.
Reasons
why, for example, a property will be derelict. They will claim that maybe a property is subject to a dispute between maybe directors of a company about who owns it and what the plan is. I've come across cases, for example, where properties in probate for a number of years. But and here's the thing, the 1990 Derelict Sites Act makes it very, very clear that a local authority can in fact go in and take CPO property or take it on and actually fix it up and actually charge the property owners for that. That's rarely done, if ever. And the problem we have in this country, Michael, is that property rights are given priority, in my view, over the social good. Louth County Council had over the last few years a very good record in CPOing properties for housing. And I think we need to get into the business now of CPOing what we might describe as commercial properties and putting them back to use. And the Living Cities Initiative would help.
Right. But you can't just go and CPO those properties, can you? I mean, you're talking about Narrow West Street and I'm sure down by the docks and that sort of thing. You can't just say, look, we're buying this because you're not using it.
The local authorities can. There is ultimately the opportunity to do that. And I understand
on what
why.
Basis, though? That's
Because the Derelict Sites Act would give you actually the power to do that. And CPO legislation, which has been tested in the courts over the years, it is tricky. It is very difficult. And it's not the weapon of first resort for local authorities.
But if the property owner comes back and says it's in probate or there's a dispute.
Or we have a plan to do something with this and we plan to put in a planning application. It tends to be the local authorities then allow them to do that. But the problem is, in Drogheda and other towns across the country, you see a situation where developers in some respects hoard land. And I suspect that across the country some developers are watching the value of that property go up. And then ultimately they don't do anything with it. So
somebody asked us there last week, I think it was just on Friday, about the old O'Reilly's building. Does the council still own that building?
I'm not on the council, but to the best of my recollection, they do. And we remember almost 20 years ago now, Louth County Council, and I was one of the lone voices on Louth County Council, or Drogheda or Council as it was at the time, challenging the price that Louth County or Drogheda Borough Council paid for it at the time. Remember, that was all part of Fianna Fáil's amazing
decentralisation
project that in fact never happened.
Provide parking for civil servants.
That in fact never happened. So what we...
And the council bought it for 9 million. Was it or 11 million?
It was about 7, I think. It was certainly a value much higher than anybody would have anticipated.
Which would seem a good price today. I mean, it's still a fine building.
It's in a good location. And there is
prime
a
prime location.
And there is a plan, to be fair, for driven in large part by my colleague Councillor P.O. Smith, to redevelop that part of town. And the Westgate vision is now on board Planola. A decision is imminent on that. And there's an amount of funding available where the local authority will work with property developers to try and address the problems.
And the plans that, there, in fairness, are fantastic. And it really will reinvigorate that part of the town. But Drogheda is probably, to my knowledge at least, the best example of dereliction and the country stepping back and just watching buildings that have been left idle go into dereliction to become unusable. And right. The longer they're left like that.
That's right. And it is an abuse perpetrated against the town, in my view. I've said this before and I'll say it again. I stand over it. We have a housing crisis in this country, if people weren't aware. And the low-hanging fruit actually is the refurbishment of derelict properties. If you look at the Living Cities initiative, there are kind of three different ways in which it can be approached. I mean, you could be an owner-occupier who decides that you want to take on a property and redevelop that. You get a significant amount of tax back for doing that. You could be somebody who owns a shop, and there are three or four properties above, three or four floors, I should say, above that shop. You can actually get an accelerated capital allowance as a business owner to redevelop that. Keep on operating with your shop on the ground floor and redevelop the property upstairs for offices or for homes, provided actually it's ready for pretty much immediate use. It's a really, really good scheme. It's worked well in places like Kilkenny. It's worked well in places like Waterford, places of an equivalent size.
It can be expensive to achieve, though, because of entrances to the building. If you're going to have a shop downstairs and apartments above.
Yeah, it was possible years ago. I'm probably a little bit too young to remember when my parents and others would tell me when people lived over the shop.
Didn't have the same regulations in place.
Weren't the same fire cert requirements and building regulations. But it is doable. And the thing about it is, any properties in those cities that where the Living Cities scheme is available, the local authority has to sign off on it. The application has to be made through the local authority, and ultimately then it's a matter for the revenue commissioners. One of the key thresholds for the Living Cities initiative is very visible levels of dereliction and vacancy. We have that in Drogheda.
Would it make any difference, though, on Narrow Westry? I just wonder who in their right mind would develop any of those buildings on Narrow West Street or redevelop them. I mean, if it was a shop, for example, you'd be lost there. You'd be surrounded by other derelict buildings. You need a combined approach, don't you?
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Colleagues like Councillor Pearce Smith have been calling for a task force, and all the agencies with responsibility for dealing with this issue should be brought together and actually maybe use Drogheda as a pilot project in terms of tackling dereliction and vacancy issues. But I think Narrow West Street is probably a bad idea, a bad example in terms of the kind of efficacy and utility of the Living Cities initiative. But for example, there are a couple of properties on Lawrence Street that are on the derelict sites register. There are several properties on the Mill Lane in Drogheda. There's a property in Brookville. There's a property actually. Planning permissions to get in for it on a new Fendwell Road. Those individual properties, I think, it makes sense for the Living Cities initiative to be applied to individual properties. But when you're talking about a collection of properties on an identifiable street or location, then it's the overall plan, like the Westgate vision, I think that is required. But what we need to get serious at, Michael, here is vacant home taxes. I mean, we have 3% of the local property tax levied against homes that are vacant at the moment. We've got about 150,000 homes, according to the CSO, that are vacant. That's far too small. Looking at the collection of that, it's been very, very weak in the first year. We need a levy of about €2,000 a year. And actually, if you're looking at 7% of total land value for the Derelict Sites Act, in terms of the derelict properties around this county and around this country, I think we need to hit people hard in their pockets. Because if you own a series of properties and you're prepared to allow them to continue to be there, continue to be vacant, they're not working for you, you must be very wealthy indeed.
But you'll still have to allow for exemptions. You'll have to allow for property that's in probate, or you'd have to allow for the property to remain untouched if the property owner is in a nursing home. And they're all reasonable things, but people will find those exemptions, and therein lies the problem to some degree. And if you look at Drogheda, because it really is a prime example of allowing things to fall down around you, it seems as though that's really all that can be done with some of these properties, that they should be demolished at this stage.
Well, maybe some should, but not in the absence of a plan. And I can't stress enough the potential, actually, of the Westgate Vision to really deliver. It's been knocking around the place now for a good number of years. The local authority is waiting several years for funding. There is a degree of funding available now, and that's actually going to see the local authority with state funding working with local property owners to actually do something special and an important entry point into our town. Mm-hmm. Remember, actually, the Westgate area, Narrow West Street, the dereliction there actually predated the financial crash of 2008-2009. Mm-hmm. I recall very well the National Tidy Towns Group saying that Drogheda would never actually receive a Tidy Towns Award. In 2007, they said this, Narrow West Street wasn't the state that it is in. Mm. That predates the financial crash.
It came with the widening of the road. It came with the widening of...
Well, I'm glad you said the widening of the road.
Widening of the footpath, yeah. A Freudian slip,
I was a member of the council at the time, and Drogheda Borough Council had huge amount of resources to be able to fully pedestrianise West Street from the old AIB on the corner there of West Street and Duke Street right up to the tolls. And ultimately the future vision was that Lawrence's Street would be pedestrianised as well. I think it was the only member of the council at the time to say, hang on a second, this is what we need to do. And I remember actually local traders, many of whom, by the way, don't even live in Drogheda, were happy at the time to lock up their shop and move off somewhere else, and that's their right. Saying, no, we need a line of traffic coming through our town. People who, quite frankly, hadn't a vision for this town were paying the price for that now.
But we still have it.
We have a glorified footpath that cost millions of euros.
We still have that line of traffic.
And some people think that West Street is for parking your car up for a few minutes to go into a shop for a pint of milk and a newspaper. Mm. That's not what town centres are for. If you travel across the UK, for example, similar sized towns, with our history, with our built heritage, with the architectural splendour that Drogheda has, if we only appreciated it, it's not for pulling in your car to do, you know, those kind of small things that you do in
you
the corner shop.
And I mean, that's everything about that footpath, and it was an appropriate Freudian
slip. It's a glorified footpath.
Yeah, that the road had widened. But it shut the town down. It shut the centre of the town down. Was it 2 years? Was it longer? It was like a building site. Work didn't happen at night in the weekends. And that effectively closed Narrow West Street permanently. And now you have that situation where you have all of these derelict buildings because they've been lying idle for so long.
It's because as well, you know, decision makers haven't decided what Drogheda Town Centre should be for. And I think we have to have a serious think about what our town centres are for. They're for people to live in. They're for people to shop in, people to enjoy leisure activities, enjoy some food, go buy some books, go buy some clothes, meet your friends.
The
town centres have changed.
But the council or an individual developer or somebody, one entity, will have to take over Narrow West Street if there is to be any future for it. It can't be done in bits and pieces like that, one property owner getting a tax break to develop their property. They're just not going to do it.
It's part of the solution, though, because if you have one derelict or vacant property on the street, it sets out a bad example, and it creates an impression of a town. We have a huge amount going for us here in Drogheda, and what we do need is that vision. And to be fair, there are officials in Louth County Council who are doing some really good thinking about public realm and local elected representatives as well about what Drogheda should look like into the future. I input into that myself, and we do have to have a serious think about what our town centre is for. Lots of people talk about the glory days of Drogheda, and I'm old enough to remember when West Street was a really, really vibrant place. We didn't have out-of-town shopping centres. We are actually as well a victim of an accident of geography in many ways, and that's why we need to get serious about what we think Drogheda town centre is for, because we're not going to be competing with Dublin. We also have, depending on where the currency is at, we're competing with places like Newry and Belfast as well. So we need to figure out what Drogheda Town Centre is for. The first thing we need to do is clean it up and decide then what our town centre is for, make it an enjoyable place again and a place where people can live and enjoy it, because we have a lot going for us. We're all very, very proud of our town. And when I talk, by the way, about the Living Cities Initiative, I always, every year during the finance bill, when it matters, we're lawmakers first and foremost. I introduce amendments to the finance bill that gives effect to the budget every year, and I say towns like Drogheda and Dundalk, similar size, some similar problems, should actually be afforded the opportunity to benefit from living cities initiative, okay. given the scale of both of our towns and the fact that both of our towns are double the size of Kilkenny.
Right. Well,
and Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael consistently vote that down.
Well, whenever we discuss this on the programme, I always throw in my little suggestion, which I think would be a relatively easy engineering solution to making it an attractive place, and that is to put a roof on West Street. The only street in the country where it never rains. Think about it. Think about it. It's not that complicated. Look at Milton Keynes. There are examples, but we leave it there for the moment.
Well, Milton Keynes, indeed, is a new town.
Yeah.
And I think, to be fair, there would be heritage and architectural considerations about what you would do at West Street. I mean, so many preserved structures.
To put a roof on. I mean, why not? Or part of. You laugh.
Leave that with me, Michael.
What?
Leave that with me.
All right. Nash for the roof. Thank you indeed for joining us this morning. That's Labour Party TD for Louth and East Meath, Jed Nash.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
Well, a text from somebody who says a lot of sense being spoken there, Michael, but Drogheda is just a go-through town. They need more clothes shops like they have in Swords or in Blanchardstown, etc., because most people go to them. Thank you indeed. I don't know if it's clothes shops that people want. I think it's nail bars that they want, and I think it's vape shops that they want. It must be nail bars and vape shops that people want, because it's nail bars and vape shops that are opening up everywhere. There's nail shops opening up beside nail shops, beside another nail shop, and beside that there's a vape shop and so on. So I don't know. I don't know if you opened a clothes shop, would anybody go into it if... you didn't sell vapes or do their nails. Another text from somebody, Paddy Duffy, who's saying dedicated traffic corps never covered the full 24-hour period. It's just that Drew Harris has now confirmed this to the public. He says if you check it out, you'll find that that's correct going back as far as to when they set up the original traffic corps. Thanks indeed for that, Paddy. A text from somebody who says they were in the Tesco car park in Navan last Friday afternoon. They left their walking stick beside a shopping trolley beside one of the disability spaces, and it hasn't been found yet. It hasn't been handed in to the office of the shopping centre. Maybe the person who has it will realise that you don't have a stick unless you have a disability. Perhaps whoever has it will have a change of heart and hand it in, please. If you have that walking stick, if you found that walking stick in the Tesco car park in Navan, will you please hand it back into Tesco's for that caller? I'm sure they'd appreciate it very much. Tom is in Navan, and he's been in touch with us this morning. He says, Michael, why doesn't everyone involved in road safety get together? There are nearly 70 poor souls, God be good to them, who have lost their lives on the roads this year, and may they rest in peace and find what caused the accident a rough idea. Everything is down to drink. Surely there are other factors. We all know speed is one of the factors. Why don't they put restrictors on learner drivers or on novice drivers? Little Johnny has his picture on Facebook passing his test. 6 months later, he's doing wheelies on the road at 2 o'clock in the morning. Tom wants this to stop. Thank you indeed, Tom, for that. A WhatsApp message that comes to us from David in Navan. He says, Michael, the whole housing problem in the country has been caused by the amount of houses that have been given over as social housing. The majority of people getting them shouldn't be getting a social house. I see it firsthand every day. Certain people should be made to go out and work and earn a living and pay for a roof over their heads, like the rest of us have to do. And this in turn will massively help the housing crisis, as the volume of houses and apartments being given over willy-nilly as social housing is putting too much of a strain on the whole housing market. If you're not fit to work due to illness or medical reason, it's the only reason that somebody should be entitled to a social house, in my opinion, says David in Navan. Thanks, David. Ellen says, Michael, all this talk about road safety, driving through the main street in Nav in your car hops all the way because of the potholes and the bumps. It's the same all around the town. Big potholes everywhere, says Ellen. Thanks, Ellen. Text then from someone who says, want to comment on the Gardaí and the rise in the number of road deaths. It's because the Gardaí are too busy babysitting other people and should be out there doing their job, says our caller. We'd Deirdre in Kells in touch asking what's going to happen with the Marks and Spencer shop in Drogheda now that that's closed. That's something else that will have to be done on foot of what Jed Nash was saying about the long list of empty buildings in the town. Another text from somebody about that saying Drogheda is an historical town. Tourism is the answer. So build a big hotel and then put some tourists in it. Thank you indeed. Will they want to go to the nail bars and the vape shops? I don't know. But a text from John on that who says, I don't understand why there has to be so many nail bars or vape shops, as the case may be. They seem to be popping up everywhere and there seems to be no rationale behind it. But then again, John, let's face it, you probably don't want to get your nails done and perhaps you don't vape. Obviously, these things are very important to some people. But thank you indeed for your message to the programme today. That has to be the final word. Maggie McGuire, research today. Chris Murray was in the control tower. I'm Michael. God willing, we'll see you for our next programme tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. right here on LMFM. Good morning. Bye-bye.
The Michael Reid Show podcast. Tune in weekdays from 9 on LMFM. To contact us, email now, michael@lmfm.ie.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.